Welcome to the Three Horsemen Plus Special Guest. I'm Paul.
Hi, Paul.
That voice you hear is the voice of one of the Three Horsemen. That would be Mr. Jeff Patterson. How are you, sir?
I am fine, Paul. Happy. How'd you get in this room?
So. Someone gave me a key. I think they're going to take it back at the end of this podcast, though.
I guess so. Wow, this is just chaos. It's anarchy. Hi, Jeff Patterson. I blog at Gravity Lens at Bad Day Studio. I've got some stuff up at SF Signal, including a mind meld for Paul that I just did. And I am on Twitter as JeffPatterson11.
And I'm Fred Kish. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Fred. How are you doing?
Very good. I'm Fred Kish on Twitter, and I blog at Bernal Alpha, and don't do much else at SF Signal right now.
Yes, you ignore my mind meld requests.
Oh! Yeah, we're definitely getting that key back.
The last person you hear laughing, ladies and gentlemen, would be Mr. John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hello, Paul. Welcome to your nightmare. I mean, to our podcast. My name is John Stevens, and I am the third horseman. Although we've never actually established a horseman order, have we?
No, we have not.
We're all just kind of co-horsemen.
We are manifestations of the primal horsemen.
So. Yeah, we're not going to get into any Trinity jokes, I guess, right now.
I was thinking four horsemen. I was thinking I was pestilence. Because I'm a pest.
Even better.
So let's get back to me for a second. I'm on Twitter as Erudite Ogre. I have a blog that hasn't been updated in a while, the jhstevenswordpress.com. Although I'm going to start doing that again. I just actually found out my previous blogger blog. Is apparently now some kind of heinous Trojan horse trap thing.
Ooh.
Yeah. Mr. DiNardo, I had a discussion about that earlier this week. He was updating feeds, and he said, did you know your old feed goes to, like, a trap? Which is bad for me, because I actually have a lot of stuff on there I haven't copied, like, old reviews and stuff. But anyway, but my current blog is safe, perfectly safe. Just hasn't been used in a while. I'm hoping to get back to that. But I write for SF Signal. I write a regular column called The Bellowing Ogre. And I write reviews, and I write other stuff. I write stories, I write critiques, I write blah, 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 all kinds of stuff. I do this.
Very good.
That's it.
Very
good.
Well, thank you guys for having me. If the listeners don't know who I am, my name is Paul Weimer. I am Prince J. Biston on Twitter. I do stuff for SF Signal, Skiffy and Fanti, and a bunch of other places, wherever people will give me the key, even temporarily.
And we had talked for a while about having a guest horseman on, and Paul was at the top of our list. Number two on our list was not Patrick Hester, but Paul was at the top of the list. We'll have Patrick on eventually. We're just going to make him sweat.
Yeah, we'll talk about comics.
Yeah. we wanted to talk about a few things tonight. The original plan for this podcast, going back a few months, have been to talk about Charles Sheffield, which was something I had wanted to do. Are you going to say something, Fred?
Nope.
Okay. What had gone through my mind in wanting to talk about Charles Sheffield was, for me personally, was the Heritage Universe books that he did, because primarily I really don't think it gets a place in the pantheon of hard SF space opera in the classic sense that I think it deserves. But for those who aren't aware, Charles Sheffield, he died in 2002. He was a science fiction writer. He was a mathematician. He did physics. He was president of SF, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. He was also president of the American Astronautical Society for a while. Wrote a lot of standalone books a lot of short stories. Very, very few anthologies previous to 2000, I would say. Very few anthologies did not contain something by him. He was a staple in Analog for a while. And before we get to my take on the Heritage Universe, I wanted to talk about everybody's experiences with Sheffield, how they first found him and stuff like that. For me, it was probably the stuff in the early 80s when he was doing a lot of magazine work. And I just started recognizing the name for these stories that were really good. And quite a few of them tended to be, you know, science problem stories, were the things that I noticed the most. But he did do some very raucous adventure stories as well. He was one of the first authors that I noticed who tended to play in a couple different playgrounds alternately, depending on what type of story he was writing. And that really impressed me. And I always hung on to that stuff. So when he started doing when he wrote Summertide in 90, I had read it, I think maybe 2 years later. And I had thought it was interesting, but I didn't think it did enough with the universe he was setting up. And fortunately for me, he almost immediately wrote two more books in the universe, followed that up a few years later with a fourth, and then did sort of it's officially the fifth book to the series, but in my mind, it's almost a sequel to the entirety of the original series, which really tied a lot of things up and painted a very large scale picture of a really trippy universe with lots of classic trappings in it. But I'm more interested in Fred because he reads a lot more than me. So,
well, my first encounter with Sheffield was probably either the collection Hidden Variables or his book The Web Between the Worlds, which came out roughly the same time as Arthur C. Clarke's Fountains of Paradise, mm-hmm. and they're both involve main characters with similar names, and they both involved a device called the Spider and a big construct called the Sky Bridge or Beanstalk. And for a while there, people thought that Sheffield had borrowed, quote unquote, from Clark, until they got a ruling from the SFWA and wrote amusing introductions to each other's books. And there, that might have sat, except a couple of years later, this guy named Robert L. Forward was talking about a double world, you know, two worlds that were in geological lock with each other. And Charles Sheffield said, "Hey, guess what I'm writing?" But I've read, you know, probably what I've read the most of is his collection of stories about a guy named McAndrew that we'll get into. That's a collection that has appeared in various forms several times now, most recently from Bain Books. And we will put up a link of Bain's Sheffield titles because you can get everything that is not in print physically through them right now. So it's a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
But a lot of his stuff, short stories, are linked either to a bigger universe or with each other, and I always like that, being able to go from a continuing set of characters in short works. And he's gone from kind of that near future-ish solar system, quote-unquote, space opera that we're seeing with James S.A. Corey to, as Jeff said, the intergalactic or interstellar stuff, to even stuff that resembles Alfred Bester. So.
Yeah,
that's what always attracted me was his wide range of even historical fiction he wrote of a sort. So that's where I stood.
Yeah. Johnny, what about you?
Well, I actually thought I was a pretty recent reader. In fact, I started reading some stuff just very recently when we talked about doing the podcast, but when I started reading The Mind Pool, I realized I think I read this before. And I realized that I think I, like in the late 80s, I read The Nimrod Hunt.
Yeah.
So I clearly had read it and it didn't read much more Sheffield at the time. But now I read the complete McAndrews. I read part of The Mind Pool. I haven't finished The Mind Pool. And I started another one of the books, which I had queued up here a minute ago, and I I don't remember which one it was now, because I didn't read very far. But I did read all of Complete McAndrew, and I read a good chunk of The Mind Pool. And, you know, I'm interested to see what you guys think about it, because I think I'm pretty sure, just based on anecdotal evidence so far, my take on it is very different than yours.
To explain what he's talking about there, The Nimrod Hunt was a novel that came out in 86, and Sheffield was somewhat famously unhappy with the ending of it, so it was re-released with a different title. And some people, like John and also myself, went in and bought the new book and said, this does seem awfully familiar. and it wasn't until I got near the end that I realized, yes, this is a repackaging of a book with a different ending.
To be fair, in the title page it does say, or the back matter, it does say a substantially different version of this book was released in 19 as.
And I read that when I read the introduction to The Mind Pool, but it didn't strike me until I was into it, like, this is, wow, have I read this before?
Yeah.
I was like, oh yeah, look at that. And then Between the Strokes of Night was the other the other volume that I had started reading, but I didn't get very far into. But I would like to actually hear what Fred and Jeff think of it and what attracts them to it, because, like I said, I think my take is somewhat different, and it didn't really do a lot for me. But I'm curious to hear from them what it is about Sheffield that they find compelling and interesting and engaging.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah. I don't know if you want to go into that, or I want to put my oar in first. I somehow missed Sheffield till the mid-90s by some quirk of just too many authors, too little time. There was an anthology in the mid-90s, I think Bedford did it, called Far Futures. Does that sound familiar to any of you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a Sheffield story in about this guy that had managed to get all the way to the Omega Point, and that was a good story. And then about a year or two later, he expanded into an entire novel. I thought, okay, I will read that. I like that story. It's called Tomorrow and Tomorrow. And I was really struck not only because, I mean, this means I took Sheffield from the largest scale rather than the small scale first. I was struck at some of the imagery. There was the character's name is Drake Merlin. There was a part that felt, I mean, the whole story is almost precipitated on the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice with what happens with his wife. And I thought, that was pretty good. I have to start finding more of this stuff. And I believe I read Summertime and a couple of other his novels and a few stories here and there. I kind of trailed off until recently when you guys started talking about it again. And then I picked up and went through the Complete McAndrew. So I'm not as well read, unfortunately, at Sheffield as I should be. And I need to backfill at some point.
Well, that's kind of what kind of drove this for me, was that tends to be a universal comment made by a lot of people when it comes to Charles Sheffield. But I think that tends to be true with a lot of different authors. For me, the thing that stands out, and I really liked Web Between the Worlds. I liked a lot of his short stories. I thought his angle of approach on certain subjects, including the Nimrod Hunt, quite frankly, I was always not put off by, but I found odd and was kind of wondering why that was the direction that he would take. But for me, when I had read Summertide, about the tidally locked planets and the artifact that connects them, I really liked the story, and I liked the setup. I liked the setting more than I liked the story. Let me put it that way, because he's bringing this. It's almost a textbook classic hard SF / space opera involving ancient races, and there's artifacts left, and nobody knows what the artifacts do, and they all have different forms, and they all tend to have different functions as well, and there's ancient races, and all that stuff was, you know, those are all the notes that really intrigued me. So when the second book came out, Divergent, it really picked up and gave us a view of the greater universe. And by the time The next two books, Transcendence and Convergence, came out. Convergence came out in 97. He had put together, in my mind, a fictional interstellar universe full of aliens and artifacts and mysteries and all that, that in my mind rivaled most of the classics that were out there. I mean, it certainly, you know, it runs at a different speed than Ian Banks or Alistair Reynolds or anything like that, but it is it takes an almost pulp-like joy when it approaches a lot of this stuff. And when the threat starts coming, they come really big and hard and heavy. And I think of, you know, more recent space operas like S. Andrew Swan and stuff like that, and James Corey has mentioned, and a few others. And I see a lot of Sheffield when I read those books. Whether or not that influence is actually there, or maybe it's the fact that Sheffield painted such a big picture that just about everything is going to resemble it in one form or another. But Sheffield, to me, you know, appealed to the same part of me that was into Cordwainer Smith and was into A.E. Van Vogt and a lot of the classic authors of that time. And when big, you know, wide screen, big sandbox space operas get mentioned, for some reason, the Heritage Universe never seems to fall into that grouping. And to me, that's a shame, because I really think it belongs up there for a couple different reasons. Number one, he really does try to keep his science very real and very sciencey. On top of that, there isn't a lot of hand wavy. There is some, but there's not a hell of a lot. And number two, as I mentioned, when the threats come, they are pretty big on the existential level. And the characters, who all have sort of vicious senses of humor, partially because they live in an absurd universe, you know, take it seriously when it comes. And that really appealed to me with those characters. That's my take on it. That's my take on that particular space opera. But his smaller scope work should also be discussed, because it is quite significant. And I'm going to toss it over to Fred for that, because...
Well, that's part of the reason I like him, and I'm getting feedback on somebody. Part of the reason I like him is because his stories, for example, in the McAndrew series, resemble the kind of stories I liked a lot that first appeared, the sort that appeared in Astounding and then Analog, you know, the science puzzles. I mean, I McAndrew's a funny character. He's so much like some of the scientists I knew when I worked at Rutgers. But, you know, each story presents a puzzle, either a piece of engineering puzzle or a science puzzle, that not only gets solved during the story, but forms the basis for the story. And not all science fiction should be like that or is like that, but it's the kind of story that I always like going back to. And I mean, he's clunky at times. I'm rereading Web Between the Worlds right now. I'm probably 70% done. And the dialogue reads more like people typing at each other rather than talking to each other. But then you get to some of the science, and it's just like, this guy is gonna land a beanstalk on the Earth after building in space. He's not building it down to Earth or meeting in the middle. He's building the entire thing in space, and he's gonna drop it through the atmosphere and have it hit the Earth in anchor. Like, okay.
And it's a lob too. It spins on its way in, doesn't it? It's.
Yeah. I haven't gotten to that. We haven't got. I mean, I haven't read this in a long time.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
So a lot of it's feeling new.
They toss it end over end so that it keeps its trajectory. So.
Right. But, you know, he has... I enjoy some of his stuff because it resembles Bester or Cordwainer Smith. He has a flair for the flamboyant, all his characters. I mean, the names are flamboyant. The way they act are very flamboyant. He does. Some of the stories are pretty humorous, I think, in a twisted sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And I do enjoy, like, the Heritage. I haven't read all of that since it first came out. And I think part of the reason it disappeared was that Del Rey was going through a big gutting of its mid-list around that time, which is yeah. where you lost... Mm. Who was the mm-hmm. guy that wrote the Northwall series? Or the, what was it, Pell series? The Breaking of Northwall. I mean, he disappeared. Brian Daley disappeared. A lot of these people just got gutted by Del Rey. And I think Sheffield was one of them. And until they started reappearing with Bane, as well as places like Old Earth Books, he really fell off the scene, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So...
One of the things that always struck me about the Bane editions of the Heritage books is that they had these wonderful Bob Eagleton covers.
Yes. Yep.
And it was Bob Eagleton not painting dinosaurs. It was him, it was him painting big ships and big aliens. And I'm looking at the cover of Resurgence right now, and I kept saying, wow, that if I had seen that and not known it was Eagleton going into it, I wouldn't have thought it was him.
Yep. But that's my my appreciation of him.
Well, Paul,
always like the science.
Oh yeah, as do I. I love a good set of puzzle stories, and that's a great collection. The Mackinder collection is.
Yeah. I just finished reading it a few days ago, as of the time of this recording, and at the end he explains all the science he had. It does feel dated. I don't think there's really a band of. Collapsed black holes at a 300 AU. When I first came across that, I thought, okay, this is an older story. This is clearly an older solar system in some respects that he's postulated some of this stuff. But I did note that while most of them are puzzle stories, a few of them are not, and that kind of threw me when he tried to do more almost social interactions.
Yeah,
it's that little subplot with that Earth Commissioner that really has it in for him. Those are not really puzzle stories at all. That's more like him and Genie trying to get out of the problem that this commissioner has, this vicious, bloodthirsty commissioner has decided to take revenge on him.
In that case, he was writing from life experiences, because there's a couple other short stories of his where he deals with bureaucracy and stuff. You can just tell that he spent way too much time trying to get grants out of Washington, D.C., and having to jump through all the hoops for, you know, satisfying every single...
and dealing with capricious bureaucrats. He was clearly channeling something, because he has a few stories, and it's just like mainline... I mean, it's the closest thing we have to a real villain in this entire sequence. I mean, we have a rogue AI, we have a mass murder, but that bureaucrat seems to be the only real antagonist besides the laws of physics that he's trying to...
That was kind of, when you mentioned that, I was thinking that the having to deal with that, having to cope with bureaucracy, and having to cope with someone who clearly does not like him, is in itself a problem story, you know.
True.
Sure.
It's not designing to make Andrew drive, or trying to find a lost ship, or trying to find a thing, or anything else. But yeah, it is a puzzle story of a problem story of a different sort. I kept noticing there's tiny little bits of social world building, but there's not a lot. He's really more interested in the puzzles, but you get the sense that okay. A lot of the food shipped to Earth. There's some very strange customs revolving procreation and children choosing their parents, but that's mostly in the background. And you have to pay attention to see the world he's building up. But for the most part, it's all about the puzzles. And it was kind of old school refreshing for me to dive into this collection. And you don't see a lot of that, except maybe in the pages of Analog now again, in science fiction much anymore. People aren't quite as interested in those puzzles.
That's true. And I love that collection because it's so they're so bite-sized, you know. So many of the pieces that are in there are so easily digestible. So
it's a pity he never got to Alpha Centauri, though.
Yeah.
He kept wanting to go and could never manage it.
Yeah, but that didn't that blow up in Supernova Alpha? So.
Yes, it did. Yep.
So it's probably a good thing he didn't get there. So, John, what is your take on all this?
Do I have to? Okay.
Yeah,
you do.
Well, I mean, I pick up on a couple things people have discussed. It is very much like a lot of his stuff is either, like you said, a science puzzle story or a very classic kind of space opera conflict story. So, like, the Mind Pool, you know, has this, you know, this sort of interesting thing in the middle that's going on where these aliens have to come together and work together. And there's a menace that's a menace in some ways, but is a little more complicated than just a mustache twirling villain. In a lot of ways, he is continuing a pretty classic mode of science fiction. So he's going back to, like Fred said, he's going back to sort of, it's almost in some ways like late Campbellian, post-Campbellian science fiction. And what I liked about it was he does try to, he doesn't just have the engineer sit there and go on for 8 pages about astrophysics. I've read stories like that. Yeah. Those are terrible. Those are just terrible. So he does try to establish a blend of progress in the story, action in the story, and the scientific stuff that he's playing with, the ideas that he's playing with. But I think for me, it was very often the case that the puzzles weren't that compelling me because I didn't have a good sense of the stakes. And what I mean by that is, like, in the very first story in Complete McAndrews with the mass murderer guy, there's a science, you know, puzzle to the side, but it really becomes some other kind of story that seems to want to somehow comment on the banality of evil, but doesn't have enough time to really develop that. And at the same time, it feels like an introductory story telling us about McAndrew, right? Mm-hmm. And try to establish, it's almost like that story is like it's sort of an establishing shot for the rest of the collection.
Mm.
But as a story, it didn't work very well. It was useful to have that as I went on to other stories, then I had a frame of reference, because also some of the stuff he explains in that story about how space travel works and things like that are useful later. But I think, like I said, the problem for me was the stories, like science puzzle stories, aren't compelling to me anyway. So that's sort of one personal strike. But I often didn't have a clear sense of the stakes in terms of, do I care about the characters enough when they're in jeopardy? Do I care about the changes that might happen to this world or to, you know, sort of a broader situation? And I also didn't just feel that the science really impacted people enough. I often felt there was a lot more he could have done with the effects of this science on society and on individual characters themselves. And something that Fred said earlier really struck me about how it kind of felt like he was talking about, you know, like a scientist who had been denied grants and stuff like that. There was a kind of a contemporary sense of working, hashing out things and not really doing speculation. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, or just, I can see that.
You know, that was so it didn't grab me, and I didn't feel invested in the characters very often. And for me, the stories just kind of didn't really impact me very much as a reader. And that combined with this, with, you know, he uses very straightforward prose, and like you said, his dialogue often literally feels like people typing to each other. And that stuff often reduces the enjoyment of a story for me as well. So those are the things that didn't quite work out for me. I mean, a few of the stories were very entertaining. But after I read them, I was like, okay, moving on. I just didn't feel a growing excitement as I went through the short story collection. Like, I wasn't eager to go on to the next story and see what happens next. And that was a combination of, like I said, sort of not feeling really engaged with the characters and not really feeling that the stakes were really compelling, other than in a very limited fashion of either solving some kind of science puzzle or sort of a quick, almost like a quick episode of a TV show or something. And then as I didn't come right out and say, but implied from what I was talking about the two novels, I didn't finish yet either novel because of those problems, again, being brought to a larger palette, but also I just wasn't grabbed in any way. There were some interesting conceits. There were some interesting ideas. But things never felt really developed. It felt like we kept going back to the science and not getting past the science to the characters or the politics or something broader than a relatively pulpish conflict. And it was hard to keep going when I didn't feel that there were things for me to uncover other than maybe a few science lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So it just never... It was fine. It's really funny. It's like I think of adjectives that describe. It's like it was okay. It was fine. Yeah.
Well, something that
but just not exciting. Not like whoa. Yeah. I mean, when I first read Ian M. Banks, I was like, whoa. There's so much going under the surface here, and there's so many wild ideas. And he's also not afraid to like be arty in the way that he writes.
Mm-hmm.
Nor is he afraid to try out a concept that may be too big or not firmly based in science, because he's trying to blow your mind.
That's the kind of
writing is the writing that I think has more often classically grabbed me in sort of harder science fiction or in space opera. Whether it's like Ian M. Banks or Chris Moriarty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's another good example.
With her stuff. Or to take it another direction, Rudy Rucker, who totally plays with your mind while playing with very theoretical, like, math and science problems.
Mm-hmm.
But his purpose is to play with your mind and to mess with you a lot.
Yes, it is.
So.
So
with those elements not here, there wasn't a lot for me as personally as a reader to engage with and to get really excited about. Mm-hmm. So I kept going back to, it's okay.
Well, that's...
I mean, I'd be interested in reading some of this heritage stuff you're talking about to see a different kind of something different. It sounds like he's playing much more with some interesting ideas and trying to blend them better with, you know, people and events than perhaps in the stuff that I read.
The thing that I would warn you of going forward is that one thing with the heritage universe is that even though the stakes get insanely high as the sequence goes on, it remains a relatively lighthearted series. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of misery. There's people who are uncomfortable. There's people who are in bad situations. But a lot of times it's either not necessarily played for laughs, but played as, oh, look at this situation we're in again.
Right.
But one other thing I would say about it is because so often the characters are in some form of isolation in deep space while they're tinkering with an artifact or navigating the labyrinth or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that quite often there are sequences where they will say, wow, what we do here is going to have a whole lot of impact on the rest of the galaxy. But wherein when similar type things occur in like Kevin Anderson's Seven Sons, we would then cut to some guy living in a hovel somewhere in the galaxy who is immediately impacted by what they're doing out there. So, gotcha.
Show and tell. Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. The other thing I would say is when you mentioned the science and stuff like that, And the engineers not spending all the time talking about stuff. A lot of times that's because Sheffield provides his own nonfiction articles to accompany a lot of stories. Web Between the Worlds, the afterword of that is actually a whole treatise on how to build a space elevator and contains a lot of the stuff and even though that book is very detailed in its engineering, a lot of the stuff that would have eaten up a lot more word count is tucked into the back. And another nonfiction article I would mention from the collection Dancing with Myself is the last piece in the book, I believe, is called Something for Nothing, A Biography of the Universe. And it's about 30 pages long, and it's very, very interesting, sort of gives you broad strokes on the various stages that the universe had and what will eventually happen to it at the end. And he just sort of gives it to you as almost like, okay, when I mention this, this is what I mean, you know, heat, death means right. One thing and entropy means another, et cetera. So I like that. Well, that's fair. There's something else I would say about the McAndrew stories too, though, is that, and I noticed this when I read them all in a row, and that is that they have a fairly regular pattern in the way they're written.
He had mm-hmm. a formula.
Yeah, and keep in mind that these were stories that originally appear in Analog? Does anyone remember?
I don't think so. I think it was possibly Galaxy.
Okay.
And he had an early association with Jim Bayon, and Jim Bayon was the editor of Galaxy.
Okay.
I think he may have done a couple in FNSF, but then there was the Ace had a couple of those kind of book magazines,
yep.
Destinies, New Destinies.
Yep.
And then that got switched over to Tor, and then eventually to Bayon, similar things.
I came across the list. Galaxy, Analog, okay. FNSF, Science Fiction Age, Analog. So,
well, the point I want to make is that think of it the same way as I think of like the Dortmunder stories by Donald Westlake, and that's the fact that yeah, they all tend to play on the same notes, but you have to wait in between each one. So, you know, I can easily imagine picking up a new issue of Analog and saying, "Hey, there's a new McAndrew story in here," and it giving you the notes, the familiar notes that satisfy you, wherein sitting them down and reading them all in a row, yes, I could see that the perception might be a little bit different. But that's true. That's true for a lot of stories. That's true for a lot of, you know, series when somebody is writing a main character in the various adventures that they go on, you mm-hmm. do tend to pick a few flavors and stick with them.
I mean, he had a...
Right.
His series about the lawyers in space.
Yeah.
I mean,
Waldo and Henry, yeah.
Right. It was, again, very similar as far as you could definitely, it was like, well, maybe this is like jazz, you know? Science fiction jazz, why not?
I don't know.
All right, I tried.
You did.
It's okay.
But it's, I think I felt a slight bit of frustration here and there because I felt this is someone who's coming along a generation later than the style of work that he's writing, basically. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of writing stuff more in a sort of 50s, 60s vein. He's writing in the late 70s, 80s, early 90s, through the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And I just felt he hadn't perhaps learned some of the lessons that I thought a lot of writers had learned in that time about what worked and what didn't. I mean, one thing that struck me as very odd reading The Mind Pool, which is a rewriting of the Nimrod Hunt, was that the aliens are so un-alien.
Mm.
They're just like dudes. there's he uses physical description in an attempt to show, oh, look, aliens, but then they're just like, yeah, we demand that, you know, our guys go on this mission too. And I'm like, I don't get any sense of these as aliens. I get the sense of these as, you know, humans who are either like a firefly composite or some kind of plant with a little creature inside or whatever, you know, race is talking at the time.
Right.
It was just never a clear sense that they were aliens. And that was kind of frustrating. And like I said, I felt in some of the McAndrew stories that there are these tantalizing hints that there's a bigger world out there that has been impacted by the scientific progress that has powered, say, the puzzles and the machinery in the middle of all these stories, but it just didn't feel like it was thought out or embraced or really incorporated into the context in a way that really made this feel like the future.
I can see
it. So, and you know, like I said, that's maybe my expectations are a little too high, but that was just what I felt very often reading a lot of this stuff.
You want to say something, Paul?
Yeah, it makes him an interesting contrast to his wife, Nancy Kress, who's a very, very different kind of writer. It's like almost like the polar opposites, where she's much more on the social and the interactions. I was thinking of the aliens in her series, which are definitely very alien in their mindset and thinking. That it's almost as if Sheffield is writing almost as in counterpoint to his wife in some ways, and not embracing some of the stuff. Well, because clearly he had to have been exposed to and know how science fiction had advanced from the 60s to the 80s in terms of what people were writing. It's almost like didn't want. Am I getting it first?
Yeah, just a bit.
John, I'm getting a sound. There we go.
Sorry?
No, I was getting a rustling sound from you. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So it's almost like as if they're in counterpoint to each other. I don't know. That's almost kind of attributing authors' motives to what they're writing, which may not be fair. But as I was reading Charles Chester, I kept thinking of Chris's work and comparing it mentally in my mind. I don't know why, but I just decided to start doing that.
That's interesting.
Well, from one viewpoint, a lot of what John said about his work could be applied. Or people apply to analog overall.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
It hasn't moved.
Sure.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, positive view, science fiction is a very large tent, so there's room for every breed from Frank R. Paul aliens to Cherry or to whoever.
I'm also thinking about what Paul just said about Nancy Kress, because I'm thinking back to Steel Across the Sky by Nancy Kress, which now that I think about it in hindsight, strikes me as a very Sheffield story. So
Yeah.
Now I got to go back and read it, because I'm kind of curious if that was conscious or not. But good. I'm glad we got this off my chest. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
you guys are my therapy. The other thing we wanted to talk about tonight, sort of spurred from a little burst of frustration that came from me, I believe. I was the one that started it. And that involved my reading of Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice, which I started reading actually right after it got the Nebula nomination. It was actually next on my list, so I started reading it. Much like John's take of it being okay, I was kind of feeling a lot of the same way as I was getting through the first half of the book. And this is something I want to ask you gentlemen about, because I think I identified my problem with the book. I find the story interesting. I find the uses of language clever at worst and compelling in certain scenes at best. I found a lot of the drama, especially a lot of the real-time drama, what is somebody going to do next, very well done. Couple problems that hit me off the boat, and I have to preface this because this is me being, you know, pedantic again, I'm going to guess. this is a book that everything I had read about it going into it purported it to be a space opera. Okay. And this book does not, in my mind, qualify as a space opera.
Well, I could argue.
Huh? That's not necessarily, in my mind, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, what are the elements of a space opera for you?
Well,
Oh, here we go.
No,
well, I'd say no. I know that that's a fair question. Well, I would say this.
Just let you know, Jeff.
Unless it's a story about man's initial exploration into the galaxy, space should actually appear sometime in the first few chapters, and it didn't for me. Okay. I was reading it going, what direction are we going with this? And that was the other problem I had with it. I had no idea exactly what I was supposed to be paying attention to either. She encounters the character and now we've got to help her. She's in trouble. There's no memory. And I'm going, why is she in this bar? It took a little too long for a lot of these setups to pay off for me. And the one thing after that that started grating on me a bit was the fact that because of the fact that she's playing a few linguistic tricks with this culture in the future, there was a bit of saying something and then explaining what that meant. There was a lot of, I said this, and when I said this, I meant this. Or she said this, and I knew she meant that. And it got to a point when we started seeing the flashbacks on the ship where that was happening almost every single paragraph. And it irked me. It wasn't, you know, it kept up a rhythm. It maintained a rhythm and it kept the flavor of the chapter pretty consistent, which was nice. But at the same time, I was like, we've done this before. When it comes to shared bodies and when it comes to strange gender configurations and stuff like that, we've seen this before in science fiction. And in my opinion, we've seen it better. And the fact that so much is explained over and over again, while it is probably a great service to a lot of readers, for me, I just found it somewhat annoying. I kept thinking back to Hamilton's Void trilogy, which had the character with multiple bodies in there. And the fact that after the first introduction and the first shock of what's happening, it's just sort of taken as read, agreed, it's amongst a bunch of other strange concepts that are going on in the space that humanity occupies. But it's still there, and it doesn't take a great leap for a science fiction reader to be able to keep up with that. Wherein in this book, it's almost like it keeps saying, look, isn't this a weird configuration? Isn't this whole idea of having these ancillaries a strange and unusual thing? And it's almost like the story kept coming to a stop to point this out to you. And that kind of bothered me. I don't want to say it's insulting, but to me, it strikes me as a writer who's a bit unsure of the ability to take a concept and deliver it home in a very naturalistic fashion. And my last point, since I mentioned naturalistic, so much of this story is told in a very naturalistic cause and effect, sequential, narrative of what's going on. And the fact that it does these stops to explain things, the fact that every sentence in certain chapters can be followed by a phrase or two to explain the actual context of the sentence that was just said, really takes you out of that style. The style kind of shifted for me a little bit too much for me to be comfortable with. Like I said, the story. Mm-hmm. I think the story would have been great if it had been a novella. I think the story itself is quite intriguing, and I'm certainly going to read whatever else comes out of it. But for me, I went into it expecting a little bit too much, and I tried to reset my expectations as I was getting deeper into it, but it just did not hook me as much as I expected it to.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well,
ding ding.
Yep. Ding ding. Yep. I'm gonna step in the square of the ring here. I think, Jeff, if you did take away all those explanations and just concatenated it all down and if Leckie just decided to let the reader sink or swim, you probably would have a longish novella. I'm not saying it's padding, but I think she's trying to build you're clearly saying it and not needing a scaffold for readers to keep hooking on to this. So I'm not, I can't here we go again with the reading author intent again. I'm not sure if the author is unsure of her own treading into fraught and dangerous waters that only masters like Delaney really master, or Hamilton on the other hand. But I think she's also looking, she's got an eye towards the main audience and trying to get as broad a spectrum of science fiction readers, including those who haven't been reading it, for like reading science fiction for 30 years, like the four of us have, and giving them a leg up. It does create a narrative stylistic tension between the story and what she's doing, but I like that it didn't stop. It didn't get sand in my gears. I saw what she was doing. I just kept following along, even though I didn't need those training wheels. But I think a lot of readers would.
You know, it's funny that you mention author intent, because that kind of solidifies something that had been niggling at me, and that's the fact that it's almost like she was trying to show you. It's almost like she was trying to paint a sign to author intent, if that makes sense. It's almost like, here, this is the way we're going to play this scene out, and this is the impact that's going to have in the narrative, and what I'm trying to accomplish is this. I think a little bit too much of that was divvied up amongst a lot of the scenes, and that might have been a factor. I'm going to go back and read a few chapters that really kind of stood out for me.
I know, Fred, that you had difficulties with the book. You were finding it meh for a while. So how did you find it?
I mean, I kept saying it was, for me, neither fish nor fowl.
Yeah.
What I meant by that was I saw a lot of really polarized comments or reviews. People seemed to either really love it or really hate it, is what my read was. But I wouldn't read any of the reviews in depth. I just skimmed past it. Just, oh, okay, you know. So, I mean, I found echoes of, you know, Cord Wainer Smith or Ian Banks, even C.J. Cherry in it. You know, so that, it was interesting enough. I kept reading, and I did read it pretty quickly. But at the end, you know, I'll buy the sequel, but it's a good first novel. It wasn't, I'm not sure if it, I would have not, if I was voting for, or making nominations myself, I'm not sure if I would have nominated this for the Nebula or the Hugo. I enjoyed it. But it had a lot of nifty stuff, but nothing, no new, absolutely new ground for me.
That's kind of how I felt, and I'm guilty here, because part of the expectation that I had going into it was built a little bit on a few of the things that I had read. Like Fred, I hadn't read a lot of stuff in depth, but I had read some of the comments that were made. Mm-hmm. And anytime somebody says, "Hey, look, a revolutionary new space opera," my ears prick up. You know, we've certainly seen enough revolutionary space operas come out in the last, you know, 15, 20 years. But yeah, I pretty much agree with Fred's take on that. To me, it wasn't even so much that it was a disappointment. It was that I was having difficulty really trying to figure out, not necessarily what I should be rooting for, but where my sympathies should lie. But that's just me. I tend to put way too much of myself into stories when I read them. So,
I mean, the funny thing was, I was wondering, because I think my interest got perked when you first complained about the space opera aspect, because I was wondering how you defined it was that I can think of several space operas that really don't do a heck of a lot of traveling.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, like, for example, this got me to start rereading Down Below Station.
Mm-hmm.
And while there is some traveling in Down Below Station, most of it takes place on Pell down below and Pell up above on the station itself. There's very little space travel. And to bring it into an entirely different genre, Lauren Weissman, then of Game Designers Workshop, told me once at a game convention that he knew of a Traveller campaign, and Traveller was pretty much the first space opera role-playing game back in the mid-70s. He knew of a Traveller campaign that had been running for 6 years at that point, and the guys had never left the city that they started out in.
Wow.
But Traveler is a universe of 35,000 worlds and faster than light travel and many alien races and a 1,000-year empire. I mean, you know, you can't get much more space opera than that, but these guys just 6 years in one city.
That's impressive.
Well,
yep.
It seemed like space opera to me, but I felt there was a just thinking about, you know, Jeff sort of not feeling it. I mean, I sort of felt that it was space opera, but I also felt that a lot of the book and a lot of things she does in the book are really attempts to critique and subvert a lot of ideas about space opera. I mean, she's subverting ideas about gender. She's subverting ideas about space opera. She's trying to subvert ideas about even about politics. And I think one result of that is that the feel of it may not be, for some readers, the feel that they expect when they're reading a space opera. I mean, there are starships. There are starships that are sentient. One of the characters is a starship that's sentient. There is some travel. The travel occurs relatively late in the book. They spend a lot of time on that ice world.
Maybe a little too much.
I was conflicted about this book, although I think overall it's a good book. I think everyone has kind of brought up some of the big issues. But one of them for me was not whether it was space opera or not. I think for me, it was a question of, you know, what is she trying to do with science fictional ideas in the book? And like I said, I think a lot of it is subversion, not in a, say, sabotage mode, but in a wanting to get under the skin of it and use it a little differently than usual. And I think when you do that, you always run the risk of trouble, of people not understanding what you're trying to do. And I think a lot of the exposition and a lot of that slowing down of the book because of that comes from an attempt to make sure everybody gets what's going on.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. I kept noticing things like something that would remind me of something out of Silverberg, or something that would remind me out of of Le Guin, or there was a lot of the ship stuff reminded me very much of Jeffrey Carver.
That's interesting. Yeah,
thought of that. And that was one of the things that I said, yes, we've seen this before, and I understand having to describe processes and describe the way certain things work, but in my mind, and this is, you know, jaded old man science fiction reader perhaps, but you know, yeah, we've seen this before. If you see a 13-year-old blues guitarist play the same riffs you heard 50 years ago, yeah, he's good, but we've heard these riffs before. Mm-hmm. And that's not it's not necessarily a bad thing. I do agree with John. Yeah, there's a bit of subversion as well as a bit of homage that goes on. And the fact that the two of them, you know, bounce around each other as much as they do, to me, it just... Part of that just caused a little bit of friction with my reading experience with it.
Mm-hmm. I think what got me more, what was harder for me to really sit well with through reading the book was in the attempt to subvert gender and to present a new gender paradigm. There was a little bit of confusion. Because the almost complete lack of physical description of people,
yeah,
makes it hard to understand. Like, for all that she explains so many things at such great length, that doesn't really get explained a lot. It's just sort of, well, I had to choose the proper pronoun, and I wasn't sure, so I fudged it.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, why? Why is it a problem? Because I have no idea what these people look like. I have no idea how people present themselves. Late in the book, there are a few descriptions. And you see little bits of people here and there. Like you get a very slight impression. And there were one or two cases where I was like, okay, in this instance, you're using the pronoun in this way, and I understand that. For the most part, it just felt like it was overlaid.
Mm.
And the problem with that for me is if I can't see the characters in my head, they're just disembodied voices. And it's harder to engage with the characters and really feel for them and really become immersed in the story.
Well, here's the funny thing. I read this both as an ebook and an audiobook. The audiobook is narrated by a woman, and some of the characters, she would put an inflection into their voices or, you know, the descriptions or whatever that gave me a different vibe than when I was reading it as an ebook.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. Wow.
The 1,000-year-old captain definitely is narrated more as a female character, mm-hmm. whereas the main character, the ancillary, is really narrated gender neutral. Completely mm-hmm. gender neutral, so you can't tell, like, you know, you said. And the one character that starts out the story as the bringing the flowers to the temple and later shows up on the station is more, I think, definitely presented as a female character consistently throughout mm-hmm. in either version. So
that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about at no point did I find myself curious about the audiobook of it, but that's
I mean, I'd love to know what kind of guidance the narrator got, because I mean, I know of some books that where they get a lot of guidance, and in fact the joke is with the Honor Harrington books, David Weber himself gave the narrator the wrong pronunciation for the main planet of where Honor Harrington, you know, is based, because everyone was yelling, why is she saying thus and such, and he's like, every convention now he says, just so you know, it's my fault. It's all my fault. I don't know what happened, but I gave her the wrong pronunciation, so it's my fault. So I wonder how much guidance she got in preparing for the narration of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, audiobooks are we talked about that on SF Signal once, the fact that I did that once where I started a book on audio and finished it in paper and found myself hearing the voices of the audiobook narrator in the voices of the characters, and started saying to myself, okay, did I just stack the deck one way or another in my reading of this?
It's strange. I know we've gone off topic. I've been listening to, I read it goes the audiobook of The Lies of Locke Lamora.
Yeah.
It's narrated by Michael Page.
Yes.
And there's a character towards the end that he makes the character sound like Slarty Bartfoss. And I just could not get that out of my brain. Like, yep. No, it's not Slarty Bartfoss. My brain just hooked onto it. I just kept seeing the character like that, even though he has nothing to do with him.
No, that's a risk we all run, especially when you get to a book that has a ton of characters. After a while, I think they just run out of voices they can do. So.
Yeah.
So, all right. Like I said, you know, I congratulate Ms. Leckie on getting a novel published and getting it nominated immediately. And great and wonderful. And it's great to see new voices coming into the field and stuff like that. It's just that I went into it. Perhaps I went into it with a stick up my ass. I don't know.
She's written a few stories before this. Right. Well, I think one of them was Nebula nominated even. But yeah, this is her first novel. Sorry, John.
Oh, no. I was just going to respond to Jeff and say it. But I mean, so much of the early press on this was so overwhelmingly, like, people were just gushing about it unreservedly.
Yes.
Which always makes me suspicious right off. But I thought, you know, there's no way to not go into this, even if you don't read a lot of the reviews, and I actually try to avoid reviews. I heard some people's testimonials and then dove into it. But people had such high regard for it that it was so fresh and it did something with gender that hadn't been done before, and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think there's any way, if you're, you know, on the internet of not going into it with some relatively high expectations. And I read it in part because Zachary Jernigan and I had talked a bit about it, and he said, "Have you read it yet?" And we were on, online. I said, "No." He's like, "Oh, well, I'd really like to know what you think, because I'm not sure." You know? And I said, "Sure." I mean, like I said, there have been so much, and it wasn't just like, "It's a good book." They were like, "It's a great book. It's whoa." And it's, yeah. And I had to see, I really picked it up and read it because I had to see what all the fuss was about.
Well,
and I can see some of what people are talking about, but it just seems then dragged down by these other elements. So it doesn't end up being a fantastic book. It's a good book, but there seems to be a struggle within the narrative, and something, going back to Paul's idea about, authorial intention, it feels like the writer is kind of struggling to give you what she feels is sufficient information to understand what's going on. And yet, on another level, is just kind of glossing over some stuff. And there was also just a feeling that there are things that needed to be thought through more. As others have pointed out already, there have been other stories with people, with characters in multiple bodies and stuff like that. And I didn't get the strong sense of how that felt to the characters.
Yeah.
I got some sense of the implications of, especially for, the Emperor of the Ratch being, this one person who had apparently infinite bodies. But I didn't really get the sense of how that affected the character.
Yeah, she
other than
she
to
said,
feel that she was now, she had once been unlimited, and now she, he, or she, that's the pronouns most often used, is limited.
Yeah, that's about the only thing I saw her mention. And she hands waves that and never goes on that again. She says it once. And it is kind of a little bit of disappointing world building, like what that concatenation down to a single body should feel like and what it does to her.
Yeah,
she avoids that.
Sure.
That was when you talk about the expectations going into it. Yeah. Okay. So identity, perception of self, and gender. And once again, I hate to have to compare it to previous books, but at the same time, science fiction has been around so long that you really can't help but compare it. If someone's going to go in and start playing with a concept like that, they should be aware that, yes, this is not something that's completely unknown to people. I'm reminded of a teacher who in I think my freshman year of high school was going to have us read The Bug. Was it The Bug by Kafka? The guy that wakes up as a bug?
Metamorphosis,
yes. Okay, thank you. And the teacher sat there explaining over and over again, okay, this is not symbolism. This is not a metaphor. He wakes up and he's a bug.
He's really a bug.
I want you to I'm like, yes, we get it. I read Marvel Comics. I'm used to stuff like this happening all the time. You don't need to, you don't need to drive it home. But, I'll go back to what I just said about Sheffield a little while ago. I was underwhelmed by Summertide when I first read it, and it ended up being one of my favorite series ever. So we live and we learn. Gents, any other thoughts on that, or can we talk about what we've been consuming?
I think we put a nail into it.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
So, Paul, because I know Paul's always reading something.
The question is, how far back do you want me to go?
Oh, give us the last two or three things.
Okay.
Whatever you're currently reading.
I'm currently reading the next best science fiction and fantasy of the year by Jonathan Strahan. I got a review copy of that, which I've been going through.
Jealous.
Some decent stories. He's trying to go center of the field, although there's a couple stories there that I think are at best tangentially science fiction or fantasy, but I'm only halfway done and I shouldn't gripe about that yet. But that's what I'm currently reading now. Before then I there's a review up on Skipping Fantasy. I finished Adam Christopher's The Burning Dark, which is space opera, though it's mostly set on a space station, Jeff. It is space opera, but it's space opera slash horror. I compared it to the movie Event Horizon, and his publicist said in a tweet, thank God somebody else saw this, made that comparison too. So I guess I'm not the only one who made this comparison. And Adam's never watched the movie, which I think is funny that we're talking about this movie that we're comparing his book to that he's never seen. Of course, I read The Complete McAndrew. I've been listening to The Lies of Locke Lamora. And the other book I finished recently was Last God Standing by Michael Boatman from Angry Robot Books. And I haven't written the review of that yet. I'm behind on a lot of my reviews, and I'm still trying to come to terms with what is the author doing? What was he trying to say? I liked it, but I still have to wrangle my thoughts into 500, 800 words, and I'm finding that remarkably difficult. I can't even say I can recommend it or not. It's funny, it's entertaining, but is it very good? Or just, I don't know. It frustrates me. I can't give you a star rating right now. I'm still thinking about it. I've also been a couple weeks behind consuming the latest Cosmos, the new incarnation of Cosmos, yeah. and I just saw the Winter Soldier this weekend, which is Captain America does 3 days of the Condor. Yes, basically.
Right.
Oh, you've seen it, Fred?
No, I've heard enough about it to make that connection, especially since Robert Redford's in it. I'm like,
oh, okay. Yeah, yes. Yeah, so they play that angle hard, and it's good, although there are some things that niggle, but that's the nature of the Marvel movies. Like, where are the rest of the characters when this stuff is going on? Where is Iron Man? Where is Hawkeye? Where is everybody else when stuff goes down?
Yeah,
that's the nature of these movies.
That's a threat you run into anytime you start playing with a universe with that many characters in it.
Yeah,
they've actually tried on S.H.I.E.L.D. to, you know, drop little hints left and right about what other people are doing during current storylines and stuff like that. So that's tough. You know, it's so funny that we live in a world where one of our major complaints when we podcast is that we read a book and we're not certain what to think of it. So the 21st century curse of ambiguity. John, what have you been reading? Or what?
Oh, so many things. I have been reading. I actually just finished Sophia Samater's A Stranger in Alondria, mm-hmm. Which is my favorite book so far this year. It's really well done. That is also a Nebula. I'm actually reading a bunch of the Nebula stuff too, so this is on the Nebula list as well. And it's very well done. It's part of this what seems to be this trio of books in the Nebula nominations that aren't quote unquote really fantasy or really, you know, fantastica, because there's not a lot of like wizards and stuff like that.
The K.J. Parker school of fantasy.
Yeah, pretty much. But it's extremely well done, and it's a secondary world, and it's a very different world with a very complex, you know, religion and different social structures, and it's. What's great about this book is precisely what bothered me about Ancillary Justice. She doesn't do a lot of take you aside and do exposition. Everything is woven into the narrative because it is the narrator's Bildungsroman. You're being told as the story goes along what things mean, and as he discovers things also, you discover them. And she also uses language in a way that gives you a sense of difference of the world being a very different place. And sometimes is excessive, sometimes makes you scratch your head, but becomes kind of an adventure for you as the reader to unpack and work through. And it's done, it's just very well done and very beautifully written. And like I said, I think it's the best book I've read so far this year. And it's just quite good stuff. And then I've been reading a lot more comics, partly because we've been reading them on and off for this. I've been reading a lot more comics lately, and I've been very disappointed.
Yeah.
I read I read Geoff Johns' Avengers Collection, and I thought that was terrible. I gave it a generous 2 stars on Goodreads. I read the first two volumes of Young Avengers, which was a little better, and actually was better. The second volume I thought was better than the first, but felt to me not like I just thought the Geoff Johns stuff was just terrible, just out and out terrible, the worst like comic book hack job ever.
No convincing here. So
the Young Avengers had I thought more potential, and it had little glimmers of interesting stuff, but just never rose to the potential. I thought of the material and of the characters who would start to be interesting and then suddenly become, you know, superheroes, just bland superheroes again. And then I actually just finished reading the first volume of Ben Templesmith's Wormwood. And I thought the art was really good, but it's partly washed out by the colored backgrounds, which are the same for each page. And then the story just wasn't that great. It was like sometimes it was funny, sometimes it was kind of horrifying in a good way, but just never gelled for me as something I really wanted to keep going on with. And that's most of what I've read. I'm actually reading Chris Priest's The Adjacent right now, and I'm going to be doing an interview with him for SF Signal later. And so far, that's you know, it's Priest. It's superbly written. It's really well thought out. It spends a lot of its time trying to trick you, and it's a very challenging read. So I find that to be good stuff so far.
Wow. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Fred, what do you got your nose in?
Well, mostly I've been reading Charles Sheffield for some reason. But in addition to Ancillary Justice, I've started to reread Down Below Station by C.J. Cherry because it kind of reminded me of that in some ways. And it's been a very, very long time since I've read that. So I'm reading that. I finished City by Clifford Simak.
Good.
Which is something, Simak is somebody I revisit every couple years with one of his books. And that was a audio book, so that was an interesting spin, different spin from what I usually have experienced it as. Unfortunately, it is still not yet an ebook, as with many of his titles. I guess the estate is just not interested. And the other one I reread was Verna Vengay's Rainbow's End, which was very scary in many respects when you look at what the NSA and all those other guys are doing. It's like, you know.
I was thinking very depressing. That BR technology that they had at South by Southwest, I was thinking of Rainbow's End and hanging able to see a consensual shared reality. But now Facebook bought it, so yeah.
Yep, yeah. And slowly catching up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., speaking of Marvel. Perhaps I'll go see Winter Soldier. But, you know, I'll probably just wait till it's out on DVD, like I usually do. And that's about it. Like I said, lots of Sheffield, not much else.
Well, good. Good to know you're dedicated.
Yep.
Speaking of comics, I'd totally forgotten about comics. Top of my list right now for comics is a one-shot, Red Sonja and Cub, which came out by Dynamite. It's written by a guy named Jim Zub, who I'm not familiar with, and beautiful.
Him I know.
Huh?
I do know him. He does good stuff.
Yeah, and
he does an online comic called Skull Kickers, which also comes out to print.
Okay.
And he's done stuff for Pathfinder, the role-playing game comics. They're comic line. Okay.
Good to know. I am schooled by Fred in the way of comics.
It had to happen.
Jonathan Lau is the artist on it. It's a story about a couple who is dragging their daughter off to an arranged marriage, and they are interrupted by Red Sonja, and Red Sonja and the girl go off and have an adventure, and I'm not going to give you any more than that because it's really good. It's a one-shot. The regular Red Sonja book, which is coming out right now that Gail Simone is working on, is also continues to be excellent. A couple other things I want to mention. Starlight, which is a Mark Millar book about a man who had a pulp science fiction adventure when he was in his 20s and is now a 60-year-old man living in a small town where nobody believes him that he went off and saved the galaxy as we know it. And his wife is dead and he's just sort of sitting there getting old, and suddenly this great big giant vane and rocket covered spaceship lands in his yard and says, "You have to come back and help us." It's been two issues so far. The art's really good. I would recommend that. I do want to check who is doing the art on a book I'm really liking right now, which is Loki, Agent of Asgard, which is currently coming out from Marvel. And it has to do with the High Mothers of Asgard have given Loki an assignment. And in doing so, they've kind of brought back an earlier incarnation of Loki. And very early on in the story, not certain where it's going to be going, but it's, so far it's intriguing. Garth Ennis has a new science fiction series that just started called Caliban. And I also want to mention the fact that Warren Ellis, who we talked about last time, has started writing Moon Knight, and he's done two issues so far, and it looks like he's taking the what he calls the hit single approach, where he's not trying to do an overall arc, but just basically gives you setup, action, resolution so far for the two issues that have come out so far. I've liked it, though. I kind of enjoy it when Warren does the singles approach. I finished... what did I finish? I finished American Elsewhere. I don't know if I mentioned that to you guys, which, wow, that blew me away. By Robert Jackson Bennett.
Bennett, yeah.
I just a few days ago started reading, and I'm almost done with, the Galactic Center Companion by Greg Benford, which is a collection of the essays he wrote regarding the Galactic Center series that he did. Also has the short story Hunger for the Infinite, which was in Far
Futures. Far Futures, the one I was mentioning earlier.
Far Futures, yep. Brings up that, and I just finished the audiobook of Heaven's Shadow by David Goyer and Michael Cassatt, and it's good. It's a good space mission procedural, and it has some very interesting characters as these two ships go out to meet this thing that's this near-Earth object, which is obviously more than it appears to be as they approach. It's kind of a time-honored tradition, but I thought he did a pretty good job with it, using somewhat modern space procedural stuff in the age of NASA TV and stuff like that. The thing that kind of bothers me is that the book is peppered with all these quotes from online news sources and chat rooms and all this stuff about what the public at large is thinking and saying and doing during the course of this mission as things go wrong and as new things are developed.
And there's not enough trolling.
It's not that... No, there actually is. There actually is quite a bit of trolling that's exhibited on there, and that I found humorous. What kind of bothers me, it's almost like he's trying to purport a world where everybody has as much of a rabid interest in what's going on a space mission as myself and Fred and the gentleman here and stuff like that. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like space in itself is much more in the public eye in this future. I think it's 2019 when it takes place.
Right.
And that's kind of a huge hurdle to get over for me. Strangely, in a book where, you know, the inexplicable happens in just about every single chapter. I can believe all that, but you want me to believe that a space mission would be the top story in the news? Never. Can't happen. That's science fictional thought is what that is. but I'm hopefully going to start the audiobook for Heaven's War, the second one. It does do a very good setup. Possibly it takes a little bit too long giving you the setup, and I think we're going to be shifting gears from a space procedural into a much more of a, ooh, there's a great big galactic mystery that needs to be solved type story, which would... Parts of it were reminding me quite a bit of Stranded by Martin Caden. And now, as we're revealing more and more, I'm saying, okay, now we're going to be getting into Existence by David Brin. And that's a huge leap to make from Martin Caden to David Brin. So
yeah, a bit.
We'll see how well that leap is made. And that's about it for me. So we apologize to all the listeners for taking up all your time and also for skipping the month of March. But we appreciate when everybody joins us, and we're very happy to have had Paul on as our inaugural guest horseman.
Yay, Paul.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
No,
we're good. I think right now the number of podcasts you're not on, it's easier to tabulate that these days.
Or at least mentioned. There's a movie podcast where I send in a submission every week, so I get my name mentioned on that one every week, even though they never have any guests. Yeah, I kind of like spread my empire.
And you're the mysterious Paul that always appears in Tea and Jeopardy. I'm guessing.
Yeah, the one that throws in stuff, yes.
Listener Paul.
Yes, I am that Paul.
You're the Gene Hackman of podcasting is what you are. So. Okay, that's good. Going to say something, John?
No, I was just going to say thanks, everybody.
Okay. Yeah, thank everyone for joining us, and we will endeavor to be back in the month of May.
Or sooner. No.
As soon as the snow melts.
There you go.
All right, everybody, take care.
Have a good night.
Yep, good night.